Right. Hilarious. All right, the big news that we had was on Friday, the Colonial Pipeline was shut down. It's a 5,550-mile gasoline pipeline that was cyber-attacked, and it runs from the Gulf Coast to New Jersey, and it is the largest conduit for gasoline in the country, and it was shut down by terrorists. A gentleman that's going to join us on the show next is Vinny D'Agostino. Vinny is a former FBI agent. Vinny, how are you, buddy?
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Vinny deals with these sort of things now in his non-FBI life. He deals with cyber attacks and cybersecurity. And I'll tell you, I think I explained this to you at one point, but we had an incident not too long ago in Oldsmar, which is right outside of, it's between Tampa and Clearwater, where somebody tried to poison the water system by hacking into it. No one knows why Oldsmar, and no one, and thankfully the alarms that were set there, they caught it really early, and they saw that there was an increase in a certain chemical in there that could have poisoned everybody, and it was definitely done maliciously. But I don't think that that was their ultimate goal. Nobody is going to just decide to poison Oldsmar. I think that was somebody who was, like, what do they call that, Vin, when somebody charges a dollar on your
Fishing.
Debit card? Phishing. Is that what it is? Phishing to see if they're able to use your card for a larger purchase.
Right. Yeah, most of these things are crimes of opportunity. So it is weird. This is something that's a common. There's a psychology to the when you become a victim of these cyber attacks, and part of that psychology that we see play out on a daily basis is that 80% of the people that are our clients, our victims, do believe that these attacks are personal. And I think that's just human nature to kind of look at yourself as saying, you know, there's no way that I would be this unlucky to be the person to have X happen to me. But sometimes a tree just falls off the top of a branch falls off the top of a tree and lands on your car, and there is no rhyme or reason to it. So I don't know much about that matter that you're speaking of specifically, but it's very, very possible that it is just a crime of opportunity that somebody floating around scanning the internet found something interesting that responded, and they looked at it. And that's how a lot of these things will occur, is they'll just scan the internet for networks to see what the response is from the network. And based on the response, they can tell whether there's things on your network that are public facing that are not secured. And so it's just an invitation. If you want to draw the analogy of someone going down the street and just jiggling door handles until one of them is loose, you know, one of them pops open a little bit, and that happens to be a water supply, a treatment plant, or an oil dam or oil refinery or something like that. And that's how a lot of these things start, believe it or not.
So now, in the case of the Colonial Pipeline shutdown, how long do you think that they were in their system before they actually let them know that they were there and you know, took it over?
Yeah, normally for ransomware matters, and there's you know, dozens of different ransomware groups out there, and they each have a little bit of their own flavor to how they do things. But by and large, most of the threat actors will be inside of a network for you know, days or even weeks prior to detonating the ransomware. The ransomware is just the final, you know, coup de grace of you know, what they want to do while they're in there. Because once you encrypt the network, of course, at that point it becomes completely obvious you have a breach.
Right.
There's no way around that. So that's the last thing you're going to do until you've done everything else. And they'll usually spend some time. You know, weeks. We had one instance where they were inside the network for months, pulling off data. But that goes part and parcel of every ransomware case that you're going to work now or that we work now. I saw some report yesterday where whoever it was they were interviewing was talking about how novel it was that in the pipeline instance that there was what we call double extortion, where they're exfiltrating data and encrypting the network. And I'm not sure if that guy was in a coma the last couple of years, but that is extremely common. Every single ransomware case we work has a double extortion element to it, because that's the way they pressure you to pay. They will steal copious amounts of data off of your network, terabytes of data. And so even if you're in a position to restore your network, let's say through backups, they're going to release and publish your company's data, your client's data, personally identifiable information, healthcare data. They're going to publish that on the dark web for the world to see. So you're going to end up paying to prevent them from publishing that, even if you were in a position to restore from backup. So I don't know the specifics, of course, of the pipeline case. That's not a matter that my company Bluevoint is handling. But I can certainly almost guarantee you they've been in there for at least a week's worth of time prior to the encryption event, and they've exfiltrated data, whether that's half a terabyte or 5 terabytes. That's what they're investigating right now.
So they're asking for money. They want, I don't know how much it is that they're asking for. So now you negotiate with them. You say, and I know you're not handling this specific case, but do you say, look, we want $100 million. And we say, well, that's crazy. We can get you $50 million. Like, do they start negotiating, or are they not trying to fight it? They're not trying to figure out how to shut it down while they're wasting time negotiating?
Yeah, this is why it's so important to hire the right company when this happens. We talked a little bit about this the other day, and sometimes when a company gets hit, the knee-jerk reaction is to have, you know, Steve from IT jump in a Tor chat with some Ukrainian hacker and start negotiations. And that's a really, really bad idea because, you know, Steve from IT's emotionally invested into, you know, what's happened to his network, and he's going to be upset, and there's going to be words exchanged, and that's not going to help. And so, you know, it's important to hire the right company to put together a strategy for you to say, all right, well, you know, you have to assess the damage first. How crippled are you as an organization? Are you 10% crippled, 20% crippled, 90% crippled? That's all going to affect your timeline in terms of what your options are. If you're 90% down, like in the instance of the pipeline, and this is then your business interruption loss is potentially in the millions every day. Well, let's say for argument's sake, they were asking for $50,000. That's not a complicated calculation on what you should do.
Right.
And, you know, all things being equal. But if you're not completely crippled and you're functional, you may have more time to negotiate, and you may not need to pay the demand. It's not going to be $50 million in that instance. I mean, you know, look, it could be. I think the largest one we dealt with is just above $20 million was the demand. And that's based on what the company did and what their worth was. Of course, they're not going to ask that from a high school. They're going to ask that from companies that can afford it. But you start that negotiation process with that bad guy, and it's like it's a legitimate. I don't want to say legitimate. It is a business, and so they're, especially with this group in particular, with DarkSide in particular, they're very well organized. They're very polished. They have a nice interface that when you go on the Tor site to interact with them, there's a chat window. All the information is displayed on a dashboard. You have a timer that's there. They're very responsive. You get better customer service from half of these ransomware groups than you would as compared to Amazon.
So that leads me to ask the question, is it a bunch of, like, when you say Ukrainian hackers, like, in my mind, all these hackers, I just picture a bunch of really white dudes in leather jackets smoking cigarettes and standing in a room that's gray, and that's what I picture. Or is this some sort of corporation where everybody's sitting around wearing suits right now, and they're like, this is our business, this is what we do now. Obviously, everybody's not going to know it, but we probably have a business front, but really what we're doing is hacking into other people's systems and threatening them.
No, it's definitely more of the former than the latter. It's not, you know, they don't have like a headquarters and anything like that. It's a group of people that are connected who in many cases won't know each other in real life. You don't need to. And that insulates them individually from the risk, right? And reduces the risk by insulating them because
they're all working from home.
Yeah,
they're all post-COVID working from home. Yeah. So this can be, you know, parsed out. You can have someone who says, hey, I'm a pen tester. I'm going to go out and try to find ways into networks, and then I'll sell that access to people who are going to do whatever they want with it. So, you know, you have a guy who says, "Give me $50,000 for this access into this pipeline," and I don't want to know what you're going to do with it. And he sells it on the dark web to another group that ends up, you know, being DarkSide, for example. And DarkSide says, "Hey, we have access into a pipeline. How are we going to commoditize this access? Well, let's go in and look. Oh, there's a ton of data here. Let's steal the data. Let's drop ransomware, and we can make, you know, millions of dollars on this." And so each individual party doesn't necessarily need to know the other party. They just have a piece to that. Just like the data itself that they're stealing, right? If the company doesn't pay, they can then sell that data to another third party who then will go and sell them on the dark web that could be used for identity theft,
right?
And filing of false W-2s and false unemployment benefits, you know, opening up a line of credit, you know. So it's like, you know, a chop shop. It's just going to be parsed out and broken down into different pieces, and people will make money on it.
So here's the scariest part. So DarkSide gets on, they shut this pipeline down. The pipeline says, okay, here's your $20 million. You got us. And they pay it. And they're like, we're a rich company and we're losing money every day. And they give them the money. Well, what's to stop this from happening again in 2 weeks?
Yeah, and that's one of the weird things as this whole thing evolved is that as this was happening when I was at the FBI, of course, when this first started coming about, the logical way to think about it is, why would you pay these groups when, you know, is there really honor amongst thieves? You know, are they going to, you know, give you the decryption keys? Are they really not going to publish your data? Are they going to just come back a week from now? And what's interesting is that the bad guys, you know, became smart enough, at least from a business perspective, to understand that if they do not honor what they're telling you, then their business model is destroyed, because then word will get out that people are paying, not receiving decryption keys, or they're getting decryption keys and then 2 weeks later getting hit again. And so what's the point of it all? Instead, by and large, you know, 98% or more, and this was something else I read in the article about, you know, whoever this supposed expert was saying, well, you never really know if you're going to get what you pay for. Look, my experience at BlueVoyant and from colleagues I speak to at other companies are 98% of the time you're getting your decryption keys and they work. That 2% of the time usually goes sideways for things that have nothing to do with them not really honoring it. It's them. It's something that went wrong during negotiations that could have been prevented. So you're getting the decryption keys. They're not typically in a high percentage of the time, not 98%, but in a very high percentage of the time, we're unable to go out and find that they've published your data that they promised to destroy. So one of the, you know, we do have dark web capabilities at BlueVoyant. So part of the services we provide is to go look for that data both during and after the event to confirm that it hasn't actually been brokered on the dark web. And it's very rare that we're able to come out and find the data that they promised to destroy actually being sold. That's not to say that they're honorable. They're just business savvy right. enough to know that that's just that they're not. That's a stupid thing to do because you're being penny wise and pound foolish if you're going to start ripping people off like that. With that said, the reason they don't come back in 2 weeks, that particular group, is for the same reason, is that it's not a good look for them. But we've had clients where they'll go through a ransomware incident with, say, a group called Soto no Kibi. They'll get through that. They won't take recommendations that we're providing. They won't fix the problems we've identified through the course of our investigation. And a month later, they're back with a Riot attack or a Dark Side attack. They're hit by another group. So that doesn't mean another group's not going to exploit you. Just because, you know, one group took advantage of you, they're not spreading the word to the other groups saying, leave them alone. It doesn't work that way.
We're talking to Vinny D'Agostino. He's the head of cyber forensics and incident response at BlueVoyant. You can find them at BlueVoyant.com on the internet. And now the question we have is that the whole world during this pandemic, and a lot of it really is thanks to Barstool Sports, we've all become brokers. We've all been using online brokerage, whether it be Robinhood or Coinbase, and we're all buying all this stuff. And then we read stories on this show about a guy who's got $1 million in Coinbase, but he can't remember his password and he can't get in and blah, blah, blah. How protected are those sites? Do we need to worry about that? Do I need to worry about losing all my Coinbase money because somebody decides to go in there and hold them up for ransom, or are they way ahead of everybody else?
Yeah, this again has evolved over time. If you asked me this question back in, 2013, I would have told you the expression, not your keys, not your coin, which means one of the beautiful things about cryptocurrency is that it is something that is untouchable to anyone else if you self-custody properly. If you hold it properly, it's something that no one else can have access to, the bank, the government. No one can, but at the same time, that means that responsibility is on you to protect that in a way. And keeping your coin on an exchange, when I was at the FBI, I was the case agent for the Mt. Gox investigation. Mt. Gox was a huge exchange in the early days of cryptocurrency. It was the largest in the world at the time that had a breach / hack / something strange happened where about $700 million of customer cryptocurrency just disappeared overnight. And at that time, that was a huge amount. I mean, it's huge now, but at the time it was, you got to remember, this was like 2014-ish. So this was a lot of coin. And so part of that is the idea that was a tough lesson to learn for a lot of people, which is if you keep your Bitcoin on an exchange, you don't really own Bitcoin. You own something on a spreadsheet in a database, let's say, that says you're entitled to that amount of Bitcoin. But you can't, if that site shuts down tomorrow, you can't move your Bitcoin.
Oh,
so if you
scary.
Own one Bitcoin on Coinbase and Coinbase shuts down tomorrow, you don't have the ability to just move your coin. Whereas if you buy a Bitcoin on Coinbase, move it to a private wallet, Coinbase could burn to the ground tomorrow and you could still do whatever you want with your Bitcoin because you actually own it. You self-custody that. It's on the blockchain. You have the private keys. You can do whatever you want to it. So things have changed a lot since then. So I'm a little bit softer on that idea. I'm a purist and I got involved in Bitcoin very, very early on. So I am a hold your keys type of person,
yeah.
But I do understand that most people I speak to can be a little bit uncomfortable with that because there is a risk of potentially losing your keys and what have you. So what I recommend to people is with the larger exchanges out there, the Coinbases and the Geminis, they have come so far along in terms of how your money's protected, how their environment's protected, how they're insured, which is probably the bigger question, that I would trust keeping money on an exchange to whatever extent you're comfortable with. That might be $1,000 for someone, might be a lot. $1 million for someone else might be acceptable amount of risk. But at some point, you should be looking to move that coin off of the exchange and to self-custody if you really want to embrace the benefits of having Bitcoin, which is that it is untouchable money that you can keep, that you can go anywhere in the world with, that no one can mess with. Until you move that off the exchange, you're not really reaping the benefits of that.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't matter to you, then just keep it on the exchange.
This is so much easier when we all took the blue pill and nobody knew anything
yeah, right.
about any of this stuff. This is Vinny D'Agostino. He's the head of cyber forensics and incident response for BlueVoyant.com. He's a former special agent with the FBI. This is a guy who definitely knows his stuff. I use LifeLock. I got it a long time ago after just hearing an ad on the radio for it. And we didn't lose our identity, but we had been hacked a couple of times as far as our credit cards and things along mm-hmm. those lines. And we were like, we have to do something. It was becoming every time we got gas, somebody stole our PIN number. And so now, obviously, there's different ways to avoid that. But do you recommend something like LifeLock for protection, or is that just a kind of a Band-Aid for something that's never going to stop anything anyway?
No, it's always good to have something like that. The alerting is excellent. I think, you know, the basis for LifeLock and a lot of the other companies isn't so much in the proactive defense as it is that there is a, you know, again, insurance that you're covered for whatever, $1 million of losses or coverage in the event that someone steals your identity. So it's kind of a weird, it's almost like selling an insurance policy under the guise of it being this proactive thing. You know, locking down your credit, which you don't need a service to do. You can go online and through TransUnion and the other services, lock your credit. And that, you know, it's something that if you're not in the market to buy a house or a car and there's no reason to have your credit open, that's like one of the most effective things you can do right now is just to do that so that people can't begin to open up credit cards in your name and things like that. And you will get alerted when people attempt to run your credit, so you'll know.
Immediately. I filled out an application for something and put it in. The minute they ran it, I got the LifeLock alert. It was amazing.
Yeah, which that is the benefit, is the awareness of that it's being run and knowing that if someone else runs it before they go buy a Maserati, you're going to get an alert that says someone's, you know, at a dealership running your credit.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they're beneficial in that way. Will it really stop someone, you know, if you're being targeted? No, not really. It's the same thing. We talked about this the other day, the dark web searching that a lot of companies are providing now where they'll take your, they'll look for your information on the dark web. It's totally useful. It's a good thing to do, but it's, there are certain things that no one's going to have access to. Private conversations, private chats, private negotiations, no one has access to that unless there's, you know, people that are working in an undercover capacity in the dark web. And even then, they're going to be very limited in what they have access to. So there are things that are being sold on the dark web very publicly. There are things, many things that are being sold on the dark web very privately. And so no one's going to have insight into that. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't look. It just means you should be realistic about, you know, you don't want to run around with the billboard. I think that was the story behind the LifeLock guy, right? Didn't he
put his social security number up?
Yeah. On a truck or something. And
yep.
then like, you know, had like five credit cards open that day or something.
That kind of backfired on him. One of the things you and I spoke about, which I think, people, it's offered now on a lot of things that you sign up for, but one of the things you say is most important is the two-factor authentication. So when you log into something, it'll alert you on your phone and give you a password so that you know that somebody else isn't trying to log into your account. I think I use that for everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And people always, I was just having this discussion with someone last week about, hacks and how they happen. And, you know, a lot of what people say are things that they see in movies, you know. Unfortunately, in real life, most of the hacks that we investigate, these very, very, very large breaches, start with some of the most unsexy breach vectors. They start with, you know, a spearfish email. It's not like, you know, the movie Swordfish, where you have some handsome guy behind a keyboard who's, you know, hacking the Gibson like in Hackers or anything like that. It's them sending a spearfish email, a series of emails to a company, and somebody opening an attachment they shouldn't open, or giving up their credentials from an email, email spearfish attack that gets someone into their environment that way. So something as simple as two-factor, which is totally unsexy in 2021 in terms of the sophistication level, is still one of the best ways to prevent some of these massive breaches. And you can enable two-factor on everything, your Facebook account, Twitter, your Chase account, you know, Coinbase, Gemini, they all offer this solution. And it's so incredibly effective because it's very, very difficult to get around two-factor. And unless you're really being targeted, no one's going to waste their time to spend a month trying to get your two-factor to access, you know, $600 in Coinbase. They're just not going to bother.
Right.
Move on to the next
right. It is good to know, though, like if you know, somebody at work gets a hold of your password or something and lets you know that somebody's trying to sign on. And you know, if even with your Facebook or anything else like that. All right. So now, if for your company, BlueVoyant, are you going in after there's a problem, or do you guys go into to companies and set them up for protection beforehand, or everything?
Yeah, that was the whole impetus for the creation of BlueVoyant. Was we were at the FBI. It was myself and three other agents, and actually one of them was my boss's boss. And he was head of the cyber division in New York. And we were going on all these breach response incidents at the FBI. You know, these massive corporations would get breached. Of course, they'd immediately dial the FBI. We'd go to this boardroom, and we'd be sitting there trying to collect things that we're going to need to do investigate. And they'd be asking us these questions about, how do we prevent this from happening? How should we fix our network? How should we protect ourselves from this? And as an FBI agent, that's not really our job to provide IT guidance and support and security. It's really our job to investigate.
Right.
And so we started to see that there was this real gap in the market for companies that needed this type of guidance to how to protect themselves that we really couldn't give given our given role. So four of us left the FBI in 2015 and started what at the time was a very small cyber defense practice that's now grown into BlueVoyant. Which is, we're probably around 300 employees now. And it's a company based on defending corporations from these types of breach events through a whole host of cybersecurity solutions. So managed security, managed service security, managed detection and response, threat intelligence, third-party risk assessments. So companies that are dealing with other companies, like how do you know how filthy those companies are?
Yeah.
You know how many breaches we investigate where you have a company that your company is in tip-top shape, but you're dealing with a vendor that hasn't updated their cybersecurity functionality since 1997, and you're dealing with them on a regular basis, and that's where the breach comes in. So my group within BlueVoyant deals strictly with breach response. So the team that I run, we're only getting involved once you didn't do all the things that BlueVoyant probably provides and suggested, and you've been breached. And you have to respond. So we're dealing with you never want to meet me and my team. That means something went wrong for you, which I love because it's exciting to do the breach response stuff. Is exciting, but yeah, definitely not a good sign that you're doing things the right way if you're meeting me and my team.
Well, look, I hope I never need you, but if you do, the company is called BlueVoyant, VOYANT, BlueVoyant.com. This is Vinny D'Agostino, former FBI agent, and now working for the. For the cyber forensics, and this is something we definitely got to keep an eye on because these dark side guys, they're doing this and they're going to have success with it, and they are already starting other attacks. And before you know it, they've become the most deadly terrorist group. And companies like you and certainly I guess what the government is not involved in this one yet, right?
So I'm sure the FBI is involved with the Colonial case, and there's no doubt in my mind.
Right, but the White House said that they haven't weighed in on it yet. They haven't haven't had any involvement in it yet.
Yeah, I hope they're aggressively investigating. It's difficult. It's a difficult thing to investigate, especially when these actors are likely overseas in non-extradition countries. So it really puts the United States in a bad spot because we have limited capability we can investigate, we can indict, it's called putting out a red notice where those people, can be arrested if they ever came to the United States. But, meanwhile, they're driving their Lambo in some small town in the Ukraine, with no reason to leave at that point. So we're in a bad spot when it comes to ransomware. It's a
I've seen 9 Mission Impossible movies. I know we can put a mask on and go put a dart in these guys' necks. Somebody can do that.
I hope so. I hope so. There are some task force, the FBI's just actually running a task force that I think it was last month was put together to try to address this with all the other relevant agencies and private sector participation. I know Blue Point's participating in that as well. So there's a lot of people that really do appreciate, including the FBI, the severity of this. It's just more of a matter of everyone coming up with some type of solution to attack this threat, because this is only... we're only talking about this because, we're sitting on gas lines paying, $4 a gallon right now. So everyone's like, what is going on? But this is happening every day. I mean, we've worked cases where hospitals, right when COVID got hit, we worked a case with a university that was going 100% remote right at the beginning of COVID that was hit with ransomware. None of the students could work. None of the teachers could work. None of the students could learn. So this is a huge, huge, huge problem. And it's only going to get worse. As they continue to get paid, this is $1 billion industry for these guys.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I'm thinking about this as you're talking. I'm like, I'd like to do this like once or twice. Like if I thought I'd get away with it, I would totally do it. I mean, it's a great, especially if you're in the Ukraine and you're like, they caught us. Who cares? They can't come get us. They can't extradite us. They can't do anything. And the people in the government of the Ukraine doesn't care.
Yeah. I mean, imagine you were 18 years old, technically skilled. Someone came to you and said, hey, do you want to make $50,000 a week helping us exploit networks and getting ransomware on their networks? And you're an 18-year-old kid. Are you going to really have the moral compass to be like, nah, that's not for me?
Yeah, also, they're not going to ask you, hey, you want to make... They're going to be like, you want work here. Yes, you do. Your family wants you work here.
Great benefits.
Yeah. We'd not kill your parents if you work here. Yeah. Well, look, exactly. This is... something that's definitely dangerous and that we have to look out. Watch, man.
I have a question. Do you have any insight into any new investment opportunities and some coins coming up down the line, sir?
He's not going to tell you.
Well, I don't know. I just figure, I've...
No, not really. I mean, I'm a bit of a purist. I'm pretty close to a Bitcoin maximalist, so I'm not really super interested in the other coins. That's not to say you can't make other... You can't make money in the other coins. Obviously, what's happened with Doge this year has been kind of incredible. Ethereum's doing exceptionally well. But I think if you're looking for 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, which sounds like to a lot of really young people, probably really far away, but for us older people, we know it goes by in the blink of an eye. I think Bitcoin's where your money should be. It's got the greatest long-term potential that if I were to bet my life or my life's fortune on any coin, it absolutely would be Bitcoin. But that doesn't mean there might not be good opportunities to make money with Ethereum and Doge and some of the other coins. It just means that I just don't know 5 years from now if they're going to be as viable as something like Bitcoin, which I think is honestly going to just gobble up almost the entire world with the direction it's headed in.
Good. I'm going to start selling T-shirts, except only Bitcoin.
You might as well.
Vinny D'Agostino, BlueVoyant.com. Hope you never need them, but if you do, they're out there. Appreciate it. And, if we find out that there's, more attacks coming, we may want to check back in with you soon. But I appreciate you coming on with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys.
All right, man. Take it easy. There you go.
Good morning.
See you, bud. Good guy, man. Here's the best thing about him is, he was... he was a senior special agent with the FBI in New York Cyber Branch. He was involved in a lot of the dark web, Silk Road stuff that you see the documentaries about. And he's a young guy, And I talked to him once before. He started when he was a kid building computers. He wouldn't buy them. He would make his own computers, and he just has that kind of brain. But he's also he's a funny guy, and he speaks normal when you talk to him. Like, he doesn't speak at a level where it's not interesting, and it's not you can't understand what he's talking about. And the truth is that this is really scary because it's exactly what he says. Not so much, it's always been available, but it is countries like Russia and Ukraine where their government isn't going to do anything about it. It's the reason why you can watch bootleg movies, because they're all coming from China, because the Chinese government doesn't have any. They don't care about rights to who owns intellectual property or any of that stuff. They just let it all go. Whereas here, when you try to do it, at least the local companies get pressured into the cable companies and to stopping you from downloading that stuff and doing it. But in China, nobody cares. So, or not just China, but it's one of the major countries that are stealing this stuff, and they're letting it just be disseminated throughout the rest of the world without trying to stop it. And it hurts the Hollywood industry. It hurts everybody. But, you know, it's good for us if you steal movies. But you know what I'm saying. So this Dark Side, you know, they have another case in Europe right now, which I think is on a much smaller scale. That's why you're not hearing about it, where they're doing ransomware on somewhere else. They have another company that they're trying to extort right now. So this is no small operation by any means, and you should just hope that you fly under the radar where they don't have a reason to come after you. Or if you do have one of those companies, you better hope that your cybersecurity is at a level of which, you know, your company is protected at all times, because they can get you in a really bad spot. He was also explaining to me one time about, like, the Ashley Madison breach. Everybody was worried because they were like, oh, now wives are going to find out their husbands were on Ashley Madison. That wasn't the big deal. It was that they weren't able to go in there and find their login credentials. So if you have Spanish at theboneonline.com and your password is, I love Mike 123.
Yeah, definitely.
They were able to get that information. Well, now they try those login credentials on other accounts, on your bank account, on your other thing, to see if the login that you stole from Ashley Madison opens up anything that's bigger to you, and that's how they get your information. So that's why when LifeLock tells me, hey, there's been a major breach with Nordstrom's credit card, and I'm making that up, I don't know that actually happened, and I say, oh God, I have a Nordstrom credit card, then I have to go change the, or I don't have a Nordstrom credit card, but I've been on their site before, and I'm like, I should be fine. Well, now they have my login information, and if that's the same as a login on my email somewhere, they're able to try and find my email. So you got to be real careful, and it's a lazy man's problem, because, you know, we all like to use the same password for everything because it's just easy to remember and all that, but once they get one, then they can open everything.
But
and if you, it, yes.
There's so many things that you log into. If you had a different password for every single thing, there's no way you'd be able to remember them.
What if you did this, Carmen? What if you made, and now I'm going to say it so you can't do it, but what if you made your password, I love Mike 123, like Spanish, and then for your bank, you wrote bank. So your password is I love Mike 123 bank. And then for school, it's I love Mike 123 school.
But I feel like that's easy to figure out hackers.
Yeah, I mean, it's but for you, or if it's not, if it's I love Mike 123 bank, and then a special number afterwards that you'll always remember. You know what I mean? I don't know. I'm just trying to think of ways. I have some of mine for the non important things. You know, logging into the newspaper stories and all that. I use BS passwords so that I can remember them. But for my bank one, if I don't have it stored in my phone, like, or if some of my phone resets, I have to go in my safe and open it up and look at what the password is, because it's so goddamn long.
And then you have to remember your combination.
Yeah.
Which is even more difficult.
Which has already happened one time before.
Hey, by the way, before we go to break, I would like to let you know that I have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees.
Okay,
so
let's
take
a quick break.
So I have the final ones that we tried to figure out which ones would get in.
Do we have our list of what we said, or do we just...
I have mine. I don't know if anybody else wrote theirs down.
I think I wrote mine down, too. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll announce who they are. And we'll tell you who's getting in, who's not.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit Hyland.com.